Meanwhile, the University of Chicago was putting out feelers about Nash's possible interest in moving there. Chicago had gone a long time without making any senior hires, even after Andre Weil had left for the Institute for Advanced Study. Now the math department had a new chairman, Adrian Albert, and some cash. Albert was looking at a young Harvard professor, John Thompson, who had done brilliant work in group theory, and also at Nash, who had a number of strong supporters in the department, including Xingchen Chen. Nash felt the pressure from these decisions acutely, and decided in any case that he wanted to get away the following year for a separate sabbatical. He wanted to spend the fall term of 1959 in Princeton, at the Institute for Advanced Study, and the spring term in Paris at its French equivalent, the Institut des Hautes Études Scientifiques, which, like the Institute, was dominated by mathematicians and theoretical physicists. Around the end of October, he began the process of applying for various grants, including those from the National Science Foundation, the Guggenheim Foundation, and the Fulbright Program. He also applied to the Institute for a membership. He wrote, "This is part of the plan. The other part is to learn French." Albert Tucker was supportive. He wrote to the Fulbright Program on October 8th that, "Nash is eager to talk mathematics with others he thinks are up to snuff. He's often rather rough on those less able, but this is standard practice in France. Nash should do well with energetic give and take, benefit from relationship with Luray." His letter of recommendation to the National Science Foundation called Nash one of the most talented and original mathematicians in the U.S. in his final year of a Sloan Fellowship. One of two or three best men who ever got a Sloan. His November 26th letter to the Guggenheim Foundation was couched in similarly laudatory terms. What Nash planned to work on isn't clear. He was at the time thinking about several different problems, including quantum theory and the Riemann hypothesis. His desire to go to Paris may or may not have been motivated by Luray's presence at the Collège de France. Giancarlo Rota recalled, "He was bragging that he had enough fellowships to survive 3 or 4 years." One particularly unpleasant episode occurred in the early fall. His investments had proved disastrous, to say the least, and he had to confess his failure to Virginia. He also had to promise to repay her. "I'll forward my debt," Nash was forced to write Virginia that fall. The amount wasn't huge, but the whole thing was quite upsetting. Everything, in short, seemed suddenly to be in flux, which may be why Nash found himself drawn to another young man. That summer, a brilliant mathematician 6 years Nash's junior turned up at MIT. By the mid-1960s, Paul Cohen would be famous for solving a logical puzzle posed by Gödel, a result so stunning that the New York Times reported it, and would win both a Fields and a Bocher. But in the fall of 1958, Cohen was a fiercely ambitious, enormously frustrated upstart. Cohen, who had grown up poor in New York, had been on the math team at Stuyvesant High School and had just earned his Ph.D. at the University of Chicago. But his thesis had not been well received, and as a consequence he had been unhappily marooned at the University of Rochester. Desperate to get away, he had begged his old friend from Stuyvesant, Eli Stein, to help him get an instructorship at MIT. This Stein had managed to do, and Cohen had come to Cambridge as soon as classes ended at Rochester. Big, slightly feline in his movements, his eyes burning with fiery intensity under a high dome of a forehead, Cohen was self-obsessed, suspicious, aggressive, and charming by turns. He spoke several languages, he played the piano. His ambitions were seemingly unlimited, and he spoke, from one moment to the next, of becoming a physicist, a composer, even a novelist. Stein, who became a close friend of Cohen, said, "What drives Cohen is that he's going to be better than any other guy. He's going to solve the big problems. He looks down on mathematicians who do mathematics for the sake of making incremental improvements in the field." He was as fast as Newman, ambitious as Nash, arrogant as the two put together, and he very quickly fell in with the other two. Cohen was competitive, wildly competitive, as one fellow instructor put it. "He was good at tearing people down," Adriana Garcia recalled in 1995. "They challenged each other with problems. 'Well, Nash, what kind of garbage are you working on now?' Cohen would say. 'What wrong theorems did you prove today? Okay, you want a real problem? I'll give you a real problem.'" They ragged the chess players mercilessly. As Garcia recalls, They were always eager to show how much better they were at whatever game it was that other people were playing. They engaged in horseplay, playing tunes on beer bottles. DJ and Paul typically got the better of Nash, but not always. Cohen was the more articulate, but occasionally Nash would shut them up. "He could say an enormous amount in 3 words," said Garcia. They delighted in ganging up on a graduate student struggling with a dissertation, dissecting a problem that some poor guy had been working on for 2 years and springing their own solution on him. They liked to argue that theirs was more powerful, but in fact they abjured elegance for brute force. "They wanted to solve it in any way at all," said Garcia. Nash cultivated Cohen, according to the latter. "It was unusual," Cohen recalled. "Maybe I liked him because he liked me. He'd ask me to lunch. He was not a friend of mine, though. I don't know that he had any friends." Still, Cohen was intrigued. He used to go to dinner with the Nashes, speaking Spanish to Alicia, wondering how Nash had won this beautiful girl, and aware that Alicia was somehow concerned about Nash's paying so much attention to Cohen. Nash never made any advances or ever said anything personal to Cohen, but he dropped hints. He'd say things like, "so-and-so was a homosexual," Cohen recalled. Or he'd say a word and ask Cohen if he knew what it meant. If Cohen said no, Nash would come back with, "Oh, you don't know what so-and-so means." People around the department were soon gossiping that Nash was in love with Cohen. Cohen was flattered, even fascinated, by Nash's interest, but he took special delight in rubbing Nash's face in the disparity between the grandiose claims and reality. He was critical to the point of viciousness of Nash's hubris. Later, Cohen would say, "Mathematically, I didn't interact with him. I didn't feel I could talk to him about mathematics." But they did talk a good deal about Nash's ideas on the Riemann hypothesis. "Nash thought he could work on any problem he wanted," said Cohen in a tone of mild outrage. "He wrote a letter to Ingham and he passed it around. I shot it down. What he was trying to do, you couldn't do. I would have been very unsympathetic to Nash's notion. The Riemann hypothesis can't be solved as stated. He came by with this letter, but any expert would have said these ideas are naive. What I admired is the enormous self-confidence to even conjecture. If he's right, this guy's intuition is in the stratosphere, but it turned out to be just another wrong idea." A year later, after he had been hospitalized, some blamed disappointed love and the intense rivalry with a younger man for Nash's breakdown. Ironically, Cohen's career wound up mirroring Nash's. After his great success, he turned to the Riemann hypothesis and physics. He did publish, but rarely, and never anything that rivaled the work he did before age 30. "Nothing was worthy of his notice," said a mathematician who knew him at MIT. "He sat in glorious isolation." Chapter 34. The Emperor of Antarctica. There is a kindling, a slow fire burning. Joseph Brenner, psychiatrist, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1997. Someone was calling, "It's time to play charades! It's time to play charades!" A crowd of costumed guests filled the entire ground floor of the Moser's small frame house in Needham. Outside, snow had been falling for hours. Inside, the atmosphere was thick with smoke, liquor, jazz. Everyone was talking, laughing a little louder than usual, heads close together, waving cigarettes, posing for the camera, still a bit self-conscious, but already loosening up in the carnival-like atmosphere. The Mosers were dressed as pirate and Indian squaw. Karen Tate, Arton's musician daughter, was dressed as a black cat. Her husband John, the algebraist, came as the Vector Spaceman, wearing a metal cap with bobbing antennae and arrows all over his chest. Giancarlo Rota looked as elegant as ever in his monk's tunic, his dark-haired wife Teresa dashing in her Spanish bolero and slim black pants. Richie Emery, the Moser's son, watched through the dining room window as a big dark car pulled into the driveway and a virtually naked man got out. There was a pounding on the kitchen door, and Richie ran to open it, as Nash came striding into the room, followed by Alicia, heads turned, eyebrows shot up, and conversation suddenly quieted. Alicia was laughing excitedly, and Nash wore a smirky smile as they surveyed the astonished guests. He was barefoot and entirely naked, except for a diaper and a sash, which was draped across his powerful chest, that had the numerals 1959 written on it. Having stolen the show, Nash grinned and bowed, waved a baby bottle full of milk at the assembled company, which was laughing loudly at this point, and then sauntered into the living room to join in the game of charades. Jorgen and Gertrude were just dividing the guests into two teams. Nash was on one team, Richie on the other. When it was Richie's turn, Nash walked over to him and whispered in his ear the name of the character that he was supposed to act out. Richie was delighted. He adored Nash, who was much younger and more animated than most of Jorgen's math friends. Richie's pantomime initially mystified everyone. Finally, a woman, the best player in the room, read his 11-year-old mind. The critique of pure reason. Richie looked over at Nash, who shrugged his shoulders and gave him a big grin. Between that New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1958, and the last day in February, as his fellow mathematicians and friends looked on in puzzlement, Nash would undergo a strange and horrible metamorphosis. But on New Year's Eve, he was by all accounts simply his flamboyant, eccentric, and slightly off-key self, playful and mischievous. Alicia was in high spirits as well. The idea for Nash's costume had been hers. She was the one who sewed it, draped his sash, and choreographed the entrance a moment past midnight. There was no hint of unease or premonition in the photograph of Nash sprawling somewhat drunkenly with a laughing, gleeful Alicia on his lap, her arm on his shoulder. Most of the evening, though, it was Nash who was curled up in Alicia's lap. Some of the other partygoers found it extremely bizarre, really gruesome, disturbing. Nash had already crossed some invisible threshold. The feverish activity and the fierce competition with Cohen and Newman in the common room, so noticeable in the early fall, had already slowed. He seemed a trifle more withdrawn, a little spacier. A graduate student who had just come into Nash's orbit recalled his not being able to keep up with Cohen and Newman. Paul Cohen recalled in 1996 that fall Nash would make little jokes, little offhand remarks about world affairs, interesting license numbers and the like. They were funny. Nash was always very bright and very witty. But they showed that something was not all right. "I'd think that's going a little too far," Cohen said. Nash started singling out individuals. One was a senior named Al Vasquez, who had never taken a course from Nash and was something of a protege of Paul Cohen's. I'd see him in the common room, and he'd say something. It wasn't a conversation, more like a monologue. He gave me preprints of his articles and asked me strange questions about them. But none of this was especially alarming or suggested outright illness, just another stage in the evolution of Nash's eccentricity. His conversation, as Raoul Bott put it, had always mixed mathematics and myth. His conversational style had always been a bit odd. He never seemed to know when to speak up or shut up, or take part in ordinary give-and-take. Emma Duchesne recalled in 1997 that Nash always, from their earliest acquaintance, which dated back to Nash and Alicia's courtship, told interminable stories with mysterious off-key punchlines. In his game theory course, Nash behaved like his usual self, according to students that were in the class. On the first day, he said to the class, "The question occurs to me, why are you here?" A remark that caused one student to drop the course. Later, he gave a midterm without announcing it in advance. He also paced a great deal, and he sometimes fell into reveries in the middle of lecturing or answering a student's question. Just before Thanksgiving, Nash had invited his TA from the game theory course, Ramesh Gangoli, and Alberto Galmarino, a student from the course whom he was helping to choose a dissertation topic, to accompany him on a walk. As they walked over the Harvard Bridge on the Charles River late one afternoon, Nash embarked on a lengthy monologue that was difficult to follow for the two, who had just come to the United States. It concerned threats to world peace and calls for world government. Nash seemed to be confiding in the two young men, hinting that he had been asked to play some extraordinary role. Gangoli recalled that he and Galmarino were quite disturbed, and that they wondered briefly if they should inform Martin that something was not quite right. Awed as they were by Nash, and new as they were to America, and so reluctant to form any judgments, they decided to say nothing. Also around that time, Atle Selberg, one of the masters of analytic number theory, gave a talk in Cambridge. Nash, who was in the audience, seemed to think that Selberg knew some secret that he was holding back. Selberg recalled, He asked some questions I thought were, in a sense, to my way of thinking, somewhat inappropriate to the subject. He seemed to see something quite different than what I had intended. His questions were formulated as if I had some hidden, not fully disclosed agenda that he wanted to discover. The lecture was about the rigidity of several locally symmetric spaces. He asked some questions that seemed to imply I had a hidden secret motive. He suspected it had something to do with the Riemann hypothesis, which of course it did not. I was rather taken aback. This was something that had nothing to do whatsoever with the Riemann hypothesis. After the New Year's party, people around the department started talking about Nash. Classes resumed January 4th. A week or 10 days later, Nash asked Galmarino to teach a couple of his classes. He was going away, he said. Galmarino, who was flattered by Nash's confidence in him, readily agreed. Nash showed up at Rota's apartment on Sacramento Street on his way out of town. Then he disappeared. Cohen disappeared at around the same time. After a few days, the scuttlebutt among the graduate students was that Nash and Cohen had run away together. As it happens, Cohen had gone to visit his sister. He was terribly upset when he returned to hear what the others had been saying about him and Nash. Nash, meanwhile, had driven south, ultimately to Roanoke, but perhaps also to Washington, D.C. A couple of weeks later, Nash slouched into the common room. Nobody bothered to stop talking. Nash was holding a copy of the New York Times. Without addressing anyone in particular, he walked up to Hartley Rogers and some others and pointed to the story on the upper left-hand corner of the Times front page, the off-lead, as Times staffers call it. Nash said that abstract powers from outer space, or perhaps it was foreign governments, were communicating with him through the New York Times. The messages, which were meant only for him, were encrypted and required close analysis. Others couldn't decode the messages. He was being allowed to share the secrets of the world. Rogers and the others looked at each other. Was he joking? Emma Duchesne recalled driving with Nash and Alicia. She recalled that he kept shifting from station to station. We thought it was just being pesky, but he thought that they were broadcasting messages to him. The things he did were mad, but we didn't really know it. Nash gave one of his graduate students an expired license, writing the student's nickname, St. Louis, over his own. He called it an intergalactic driver's license. He mentioned that he was a member of a committee, and that he was putting the student in charge of Asia. The student recalled, "He seemed to be joking around." His manner took on a certain furtiveness. Another student, an undergraduate, recalled, "I have this impression of him darting about. I'd walk into a stairwell and he'd disappear as if he'd been lurking there." Nash showed up at the apartment of John and Karen Tate one evening. Everybody was horsing around, and finally they settled down to play a game of bridge. Nash's partner was Karen Tate. His bidding was bizarre. At one point he bid 6 hearts, when as it turned out he held no hearts at all. Karen asked him, "Are you crazy?" Nash responded quite calmly, explaining that he somehow had expected her to read his bids. "He expected me to understand. He generally thought I could understand. I thought he was pulling my leg, but it became obvious that he wasn't. I thought he was doing some sort of experiment." Some people continued to think Nash was engaged in some elaborate private joke. There was a lot of discussion about it. Nash's recollections of those weeks focus on a feeling of mental exhaustion and depletion, recurring and increasingly pervasive images, and a growing sense of revelation regarding a secret world that others around him were not privy to. He began, he recalled in 1996, to notice men in red neckties around the MIT campus. The men seemed to be signaling to him. "I got the impression that other people at MIT were wearing red neckties, so I would notice them. As I became more and more delusional, not only persons at MIT, but people in Boston wearing red neckties would seem significant to me." At some point, Nash concluded that the men in red ties were part of a definite pattern. "Also, there was some relation to a crypto-communist party," he said in 1996. Things started happening fast. Alicia Nash later compared Nash's disintegration to that of a man who is conversing quite normally at a dinner party, suddenly starts arguing loudly, and finally has an all-out temper tantrum. He told Cohen, "People are talking about me, you've heard them. Tell me what they're saying." Cohen recalled, It had a nasty edge. I told him I didn't know what he was talking about, that I hadn't heard anything. Nash was still working on the Riemann problem. Once Nash accused Cohen of rifling through his trash can, was he trying to steal Nash's ideas about Riemann? Again, it sounded like a bit of an over-the-top joke, but it upset Cohen sufficiently so that he repeated the incident to a student. In mid-February, Harold Kuhn, who was on a Fulbright in London with Estelle and his children, spent a few days in Paris, where he visited a French mathematician, Claude Berge. Berge showed Kuhn a letter from Nash, written in four colors of ink, complaining that his career was being ruined by aliens from outer space. Possibly the event that triggered Nash's strange letter to Berge was the announcement of the winner of the 1959 Booker Prize, Louis Nirenberg, the current professor who had suggested the partial differential equation problem to Nash. Paul Cohen later recalled that Nash's reaction was furious. He told Cohen that he deserved the prize, and that the fact that an older mathematician had won it was merely a sign that these things were political. Nash also approached Neuwirth about his work. He said he was giving this lecture on the Riemann hypothesis, Neuwirth recalled. But when he started talking, it was gibberish. Probability is everything. I knew that was crazy. I mentioned it to Newman, who brushed it off. On yet another occasion, Nash wandered into Moser's office, unannounced as always. Moser, always affable, suppressed a feeling of irritation and waved him in. Nash stood at the blackboard. He drew a set that resembled a large, wavy, baked potato. He drew a couple of other smaller shapes to the right. Then he fixed a long gaze on Moser. "This," he said, pointing to the potato, "is the universe." Moser nodded. Moser was at that time engaged in trying to apply Nash's implicit function theorem to certain problems in celestial mechanics. "This is the government," Nash said in the same tone that used to say, "This is an elliptic equation." "This is heaven, and this is hell." Ted and Lucy Martin had been in Mexico on a winter vacation. When Martin returned, Levinson took him aside and told him that Nash was having a nervous breakdown. "Tell me about it," said Martin, who said later that he almost didn't believe in these things. Martin recalled, "Levinson said he's very paranoid. If you go down to his office, he won't want you between him and the door." Sure enough, when I went down to his office that Sunday night, Nash edged himself over between me and the door. Strange letters began turning up in the department mail. Ruth Goodwin, the department secretary, would put them aside and show them to Martin. They were addressed to ambassadors of various countries, and they were from John Nash. Martin panicked. He tried to retrieve the letters, not all of which were addressed, and most of which weren't stamped, from mailboxes around the campus. What was in the letters? None have survived, but various people recalled hearing from Martin that Nash was forming a world government. There was a committee that consisted of Nash and various students and colleagues in the department. The letters were addressed to all the embassies in Washington, D.C. The letters said he was forming a world government. He wanted to talk to the ambassadors. Later he would talk to the heads of state. Martin was in a most awkward position. The faculty, after some internal dissension, had just voted on Nash's promotion, and it was now before the president of the university. He dithered and delayed. Meanwhile, Adrian Albert, the chairman of the mathematics department at the University of Chicago, called Norman Levinson. "What was Nash's state of mind?" he asked Levinson. Chicago had made an offer of a prestigious chair to Nash. Nash was scheduled to give a talk, and now he had received a very odd letter from Nash. It was a refusal of the Chicago offer. Nash had thanked Albert for his kind offer, but said he would have to decline because he was scheduled to become Emperor of Antarctica. The letter, Browder recalled in 1996, also contained references to Ted Martin's stealing Nash's ideas. The affair came to the attention of MIT President Julius Stratton, who, upon seeing a copy of Nash's letter, is supposed to have said, "This is a very sick man." The spring term began February 9th. Shortly after Washington's birthday, Eugenio Calabi, who was a member that year of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, gave a seminar at MIT. Undergraduates, even very bright ones, didn't normally attend departmental seminars, but Al Vasquez, a senior, decided he would go. He put on a sport coat and tie for the occasion. Feeling rather self-conscious, he sat a few rows from the rear and hoped that he looked less conspicuous than he felt. He had noticed as he sat down that Nash was sitting in the row behind him. In the middle of Kalabi's lecture, Nash started speaking rather loudly, although he did not appear to be addressing Kalabi. After a few moments, Vasquez realized that Nash was talking to him. "Vasquez, did you know that I'm on the cover of Life magazine?" Nash kept repeating until Vasquez turned around. Nash told Vasquez that his photograph had been disguised to make it look as if it were Pope John the 23rd. Vasquez, he said, also had his picture on a Life cover, and it too was disguised. How did he know that the photograph, apparently of the Pope, was really of himself? Two ways, he explained. First, because John wasn't the Pope's given name, but a name that he had chosen. Second, because 23 was Nash's favorite prime number. Almost the strangest thing, Vasquez later recalled, was that Kalabi kept on lecturing as if nothing untoward were happening, and the rest of the audience, too, ignored the interchange, although it must have been audible to everyone in the room. Nash and Kalabi knew each other from their graduate school days at Princeton. Before Kalabi had come up to Cambridge, Nash had telephoned him at his apartment on Einstein Drive and asked whether the Kalabis would put him and Alicia up for a few days. He wanted to spend a few days at the Institute consulting with Atlee Selberg, the number theorist, and preparing a talk that he was scheduled to give at the upcoming Regional Math Society meeting. Kalabi and the Nashes went out to dinner after Kalabi's talk. Both Nashes seemed unusually nervous, Kalabi recalled. At one point, Nash made a wrong turn and Alicia began yelling hysterically. He was somewhat anxious. The next day, the Nashes left for Princeton while Kalabi stayed on in Cambridge. A day or two later, Kalabi got a call from his wife, Juliana, who said that Nash was behaving very strangely and would he come home. On one occasion, Nash had walked into another apartment, used the bathroom, and walked out again. All the apartments on Einstein Drive looked virtually identical from the outside, and mistakes were commonplace, but even afterward, Nash didn't seem to be aware that he had been in the wrong apartment. On the afternoon of February 28th, Nash was even more agitated. Kalabi had just returned. He was acting much more nervous than usual, very agitated. At the moment of leaving, he was misplacing notes, running back and forth between the car and the house. Alicia was trying to calm him down. Kalabi watched, full of misgivings. Speaking of Nash's mathematical investigation, he said, "I knew in that area that problem was not going to yield to a flash of inspiration." Nash's consultations with Selberg apparently came to naught. Selberg had merely been irritated by Nash's persistence, as he later recalled, and told Nash, in even harsher terms, that the probabilistic approach he was pursuing had been tried before, and had already been demonstrated to be fruitless. One can only imagine the fear and confusion that Nash felt that afternoon as he stood before the 250 or so mathematicians who came to his lecture, sponsored by the American Mathematical Society, in a Columbia University auditorium. Harold N. Shapiro, a professor at the Courant Institute and a number theorist who had known Nash since the summer they spent together at RAND in 1952, introduced Nash. There was, in fact, an air of tremendous expectation in the hall. Regional AMS meetings were essentially job meetings. The audience consisted both of job seekers and established mathematicians, among them many who knew Nash and his work intimately. Here was a great young mathematician with a proven ability for tackling the most difficult problems, about to announce what he felt was a likely solution to the deepest problem in all of mathematics, recalled Shapiro. I remember hearing that he was interested in prime numbers. Everybody's reaction was that if Nash turns to number theorists better watch out. There was a buzz. Peter Lax, a professor at the Courant Institute, described it as a very strange adventure. Lippmann Behrs reminded me as we were listening to Nash's talk that Heifetz gave his first concert at Carnegie, accompanied by the pianist Godofsky. An older violinist, turning to the musician seated next to him, said, "It's very hot in here." "Not for the pianist," came the answer. It must have been hot in there, but only for the number theorists in the audience. It was work in progress. I couldn't judge it. Mathematicians don't usually present unfinished work. At first, it seemed like just another of Nash's cryptic, disorganized performances, more free association than exposition. But halfway through, something happened. Donald Newman recalled in 1996, "One word didn't fit in with the other. I was at yeshiva. Rademacher, who had worked on the Riemann hypothesis, was present. In fact, he wrote a brilliant paper on how not to solve the Riemann hypothesis. It was Nash's first downfall. Everybody knew something was wrong. He didn't get stuck. It was his chatter. The math was just lunacy. What does this have to do with the Riemann hypothesis? Some people didn't catch it. People go to these meetings and sit through lectures, and they go out in the hall, buttonhole other people, and try to figure out what they just heard. Nash's talk wasn't good or bad. It was horrible." Kathleen Morowetz, who had enjoyed joking around with Nash at Courant 2 years earlier, ran into Nash in the stairwell after the talk. "He was laughed out of the auditorium," she recalled. "I felt terrible. I said something nice to him, but I was disturbed. He seemed very depressed." Later, Kathleen used the phrase, "heaping scorn on him," to describe the audience reaction. Nash had been invited to give a talk at Yale as well on his way back to Cambridge. It was his second talk at Yale that year, but he couldn't find his way there. He kept calling Felix Browder, then teaching at Yale, and telling him that he couldn't understand how to get off the Merritt Parkway. Nash talked about the Riemann hypothesis just as he had at Columbia. Again, it was a disastrous performance, as recalled by Browder, who contrasted his performance with the earlier one. "The preceding year, there was no hint of trouble. That is when he finished the parabolic equations proof. In fact, he completed the proof during a talk. I had asked him if he wanted to come and give another talk at Yale. It wasn't coherent. I thought something was wrong." Chapter 35. In the Eye of the Storm. Spring 1959. "It was like a tornado. You want to hang on to what you have. You don't want to see everything go." Alicia Nash. Despite Alicia's apparent elation on New Year's Eve, her state of mind in the preceding months had been anything but carefree. Since returning from their European holiday, her starry-eyed view of her new life had given way to a darker, more somber perspective. She and Nash had moved out to West Medford, a small industrial city north of Cambridge, and Alicia felt cut off and isolated. Her goal of establishing a career seemed more distant than ever. Her feelings about her pregnancy were ambivalent, and her initial hopes that it would draw her and Nash closer were disappointed. Her husband had become, if anything, more cold and distant. As the weather turned colder and the days shorter, she felt more and more dispirited, anxious, and alone, so much so that she was thinking of consulting a psychiatrist. That had been before Thanksgiving. Since then, Nash's behavior, rather than her own low mood, had become her chief source of distress. Several times Nash had cornered her with odd questions when they were alone, either at home or driving in the car. "Why don't you tell me about it?" he asked in an angry, agitated tone, apropos of nothing. "Tell me what you know," he demanded. He behaved as if she knew some secret but wouldn't share it with him. The first time he said it, Alicia thought Nash suspected her of having an affair. When he repeated it, she wondered whether he might not be having an affair himself. That would account for his growing secretiveness and air of abstraction. Might he not be trying to deflect attention from himself by accusing her? By New Year's Day, the day she turned 26, Alicia was sure that something was wrong. Nash's behavior had become more and more peculiar. He was irritable and hypersensitive one minute, eerily withdrawn the next. He complained that he knew something was going on, and that he was being bugged. And he was staying up nights writing strange letters to the United Nations. One night, after he had painted black spots all over their bedroom wall, Alicia made him sleep on the living room couch. Alarmed, Alicia searched for explanations rooted in their day-to-day life. Her first thought was that Nash was unduly worried about the impending tenure decision. She suspected that the prospect of a baby, with all the new responsibilities that implied, was another source of pressure. And she wondered whether marriage to someone different like her wasn't proving too much of a strain for a southern wasp. Alicia vainly tried to reassure Nash. She told him over and over that his worries about tenure were unfounded, that he was the department's fair-haired boy, that Martin, after all, was confident that the decision would be favorable. She reasoned with him, pointing out that the letter writing could undermine his professional credibility and might even jeopardize his tenure. When that failed, she remonstrated with him. "You can't act silly," she would say. Then Nash did a number of things that frightened her, and made inescapable the conclusion that he was suffering some sort of mental breakdown. He started to threaten to take all of his savings out of the bank and move to Europe. He had some idea, it seemed, of founding an international organization, and he began to stay up night after night, long after she had gone to bed, writing. In the morning, his desk would be covered with sheets of paper covered in blue, green, red, and black ink. They were addressed not just to the UN, but to various foreign ambassadors, the Pope, even the FBI. It was in mid-January, while classes were still in session, that Nash took off for Roanoke in the middle of the night, after a wild scene. Seeing no alternative, Alicia broke her silence and telephoned Virginia to warn her. She told her mother-in-law very little, though, as Martha recalled, other than that Nash was suffering from stress and was behaving somewhat irrationally. When he arrived in Roanoke, Virginia and Martha were frightened by his agitated state. At one point, he struck Virginia on the arm. When Nash returned, he continued to badger Alicia in private. Once he threatened to hit her, "If you don't tell me." Alicia was initially more worried about Nash and their future together than about any physical threats to herself. Her immediate overwhelming instinct was to prevent the university from finding out about Nash's difficulties. I didn't want the bad things to get out. She quit her job at technical operations and took one at the computer center on campus. She began to watch Nash all the time, to stick very close to him, to keep him more to herself. She would stop by the mathematics department every afternoon after work and pick him up. She no longer invited others to join them when they ate out. She particularly tried to avoid Paul Cohen, although Nash's insistence sometimes made this impossible. Alicia wanted to save his career and preserve his intellect, a friend of Alicia's later recalled. It was in her interest to keep Nash intact. She was extremely tough. Until the Roanoke episode, Alicia had confided in no one. Now she consulted a psychiatrist from the MIT Medical Department, a Dr. Haskell Schell. She also asked Emma to have lunch with her alone a few times, and although reluctantly and holding much back, told her friend some of what had been happening. At the beginning it seemed to Alicia that her psychiatrist was more intent on asking her questions about her upbringing, her marriage, her sex life, than on offering practical advice on how to cope. At first Alicia trusted them because it was MIT, Emma recalled, but it was a very Freudian time. The psychiatry department was ultra-Freudian. They wanted to treat Alicia. She wanted practical help. Emma continued. They asked Alicia a lot of questions. She got very impatient. Nash was threatening to go off to Europe to withdraw all their money to start an international organization. She was looking into the laws. She found out that you could have somebody committed for a limited time with the signature of two psychiatrists. To keep them longer, you had to have a court hearing. Emma was working with Jerome Lechtman, a former psychiatrist who was now pursuing research in neurophysiology at MIT. She asked Lechtman what Alicia should do. The result was that Alicia got very conflicting advice. On the one hand, Lechtman was urging her, through Emma, to consider shock treatments. Lechtman's idea was that when anybody was delusional, the sooner he was shocked out of it, the better, Emma recalled. On the other hand, Schell was recommending that Nash go to McLean Hospital, an ultra-Freudian institute that eschewed shock treatments in favor of psychoanalysis and new antipsychotic drugs like Thorazine. Alicia rejected the notion of shock treatment. She was very concerned with preserving his genius, Emma stated in 1997. She wasn't going to force anything on him. She also wanted there to be nothing that would interfere with his brain, no drugs, no shock treatments. In January, the department voted to give Nash tenure. A few weeks later, Martin, now aware that Nash was suffering some sort of nervous breakdown, decided to relieve Nash of his teaching duties for the coming semester. Although distressed that the university had found out about Nash's problems, Alicia was greatly relieved. She hoped that this move would lift some of the pressures on Nash, and that he would improve spontaneously. Deciding what, if anything, to do was so difficult because Nash often seemed quite normal. The on-again-off-again nature of his symptoms also convinced some of his colleagues and graduate students in the department that nothing was seriously wrong. Giancarlo Rota recalled that Nash's personality didn't seem very different, although his mathematics no longer made sense. Some days everything looked just as it always had, and Alicia found herself wondering, until the next outburst of bizarre behavior, whether she'd been exaggerating, unnecessarily alarmed, premature in her judgments. In mid-March, 2 weeks after the disastrous New York trip when Nash had given his lecture on the Riemann hypothesis, Nash was writing reassuring letters home. "My talk in New York went reasonably well," he wrote Virginia on March 12th, urging her to come up to Boston to visit him and Alicia. On the same day, he even wrote a long letter to Martha in which he complained of boredom. Nash wrote, "Since she has become pregnant, Alicia does not like to go out. She enjoys TV and movie magazines. These things tend to bore me. The level is too low." But these periods of lucidity and calm soon gave way to an eruption that Alicia later compared to a tornado. The episode that convinced Alicia that she had no choice but to seek treatment for Nash occurred around Easter. Nash took off for Washington, D.C. in his Mercedes. He was, it appeared, trying to deliver letters to foreign governments by dropping them into the mail slots of embassies. This time Alicia went with him. Before they left, she telephoned her friend Emma and asked her to contact the university psychiatrist if they did not return within a week or so. Emma recalled in 1997 that Alicia was afraid Nash might harm her. Curiously, her concern, at least in Emma's recollection, was less for herself than for Nash. She wanted the world to know that Nash was mad. She was worried about Nash. She worried that if she came to harm, that he'd be treated like a common criminal. So she wanted to be sure that everyone knew that he was insane. When Emma did call Shell, he refused to come to the telephone and had a nurse tell her that Dr. Shell doesn't discuss his patients. She added, "I was interviewed at Lincoln Labs about Alicia. I was asked whether she was afraid of her husband. But she wasn't. He was just very sick." Emma's impressions to the contrary, Alicia was afraid, though she managed to hide her fear from almost everyone. Paul Cohen, however, recalled that she was afraid of him. A few weeks later, she would tell Gertrude Moser, who questioned her decision to have Nash hospitalized, that in Gertrude's words, something had happened in the middle of the night, and she had to save herself and the child. It was fear for her own safety, as well as her psychiatrist's warning that Nash would continue to deteriorate unless he got treatment, that prompted her to seek commitment, at least for observation. She wished, however, to conceal what he would inevitably regard as an act of treachery, so she turned to her mother-in-law and asked her to come to Boston. George Whitehead, one of Nash's colleagues, had temporarily moved to Princeton with his wife Kay. In mid-April, the Whiteheads drove up to Boston to have their car, which was still registered in Massachusetts, inspected. It was an annual ritual. That evening, they went to a party at the home of Oscar Goldman in Concord. Most of the MIT mathematics department was there. Kay recalled in 1995, "The word was, tomorrow Alicia is having John committed." Obviously, there was a lot of talk about it. Chapter 36. Daybreaks in Bowditch Hall. McLean Hospital, April to May, 1959. This is the way daybreaks in Bowditch Hall at McLean's. Waking in the blue. Life Studies, Robert Lowell. When a stranger in a suit knocked on Paul Cohen's office door to inquire whether he had seen Dr. Nash that afternoon, the man's slightly unctuous, self-important manner made Cohen wonder whether this was the psychiatrist who was going to have Nash locked up. For days, the younger people in the department had been speculating, based on hints dropped by Ambrose and some of the other senior faculty, that Nash's wife was about to have him committed. Furious controversies had broken out over whether Nash was truly insane or merely eccentric, and over whether, insane or not, anyone had the right to rob a genius like Nash of his freedom. Cohen, who felt that he had been somehow unfairly implicated in the whole affair, had pretty much steered clear of these debates, but he nonetheless felt a certain morbid fascination. To the stranger, however, he merely said no, he hadn't seen Dr. Nash all day. So when Nash showed up at Cohen's door not very long afterward, seemingly oblivious to whatever machinations were underway, Cohen was more than a little surprised. Nash wanted to know if Cohen would like to go for a walk with him. Cohen agreed, and the two wandered around the MIT campus for an hour or more. As they walked, Nash spoke in a fitful monologue while Cohen listened, perplexed and uncomfortable. Occasionally Nash would stop, point at something, and whisper conspiratorially, "Look at that dog over there. He's following us." He frightened Cohen a bit by talking about Alicia in a way that made the younger man feel that she might be in danger. After they parted, Cohen learned later, Nash was picked up and taken to McLean Hospital. It was not difficult to get someone into McLean, even if they did not want to go. Nash's involuntary commitment to a mental hospital for observation was likely arranged by MIT's psychiatric service, probably in consultation with the president of the university, as well as Martin and Levinson. Given Nash's acute paranoia, his bizarre letter writing, his inability to teach, and the potential that he might carry out his threats to harm Alicia, the pressure to intervene would have been great. One imagines that before taking the drastic measure of involuntary commitment, one of the psychiatrists in MIT's employ attempted to convince Nash to obtain treatment voluntarily first. Merton J. Kahn, a professor of psychiatry at MIT who ran McLean's admissions ward during the 1950s, said in 1996, "They would have tried to figure out how to get him into therapy without coercion. A lot of heads would have been put together to try to find a solution. In those days, there was an attempt to maintain some respect for the human being, whether they were crazy or not. They weren't interested in peremptorily putting someone in the hospital against their will. The stigma was enormous." The decision was an especially tricky one because of Nash's prominent position at the university, and because, as is often the case, it was inherently controversial. As Kahn put it, "The more powerful or exceptional the individual, the more controversial the decision." The mechanics, however, were fairly straightforward. Any psychiatrist could apply to a mental hospital to have a patient taken for a 10-day observation period. A university psychiatrist would have signed a temporary care order, a so-called pink paper, asking McLean to take Nash on the grounds that he was a danger to himself or others, although a simple inability to care for oneself was sufficient grounds. The pink paper gave MIT the right to pick Nash up and transport him to McLean. Technically, it was the hospital that made the decision to hold a patient, initially for a 10-day period. That April evening, some hours after Nash and Cohen parted company, two Cambridge policemen arrived at the Nash's West Medford house. As Nash recalls, "They as if arrested me." The use of police officers was by all accounts an extreme measure. It suggested that the university psychiatrists were expecting trouble. Most cases of involuntary commitment involving university personnel were handled far more discreetly, in a manner designed to avoid scandal and humiliation, by out-of-uniform campus police driving a gray Chevrolet station wagon marked only with maroon lettering, whose interior was equipped as an ambulance. As it happened, Nash refused to go, and a scuffle ensued. "I actually struggled with them in resistance at first," he recalled. Resistance was useless, however. Big and strong as he was, Nash was quickly overpowered and bundled into the back of the police cruiser. The drive from West Medford to Belmont took less than half an hour. 115 Mill Street, Belmont, Massachusetts, was, and still is, a verdant 240-acre expanse of rolling lawns and winding lanes and a scattering of buildings of old brick and ironwork, nestled among majestic trees, or perched airily on rises, a precise copy, that is to say, of a well-manicured New England college campus of late 19th-century vintage. Many of its smaller buildings were designed to resemble the homes of wealthy Boston Brahmins, long the bulk of McLean's clientele. A psychiatrist who reviewed the hospital for the American Psychiatric Association in the late 1940s recalled, "There were all these little two-story homes with suites, kitchen, living room, bedroom. They had suites for the cook, the maid, the chauffeur." Upham House, a former medical resident recalled, had four corner suites per floor, and on one of its floors all four patients turned out to be members of the Harvard Club. McLean was, as it still is, connected to Harvard Medical School. So many of the wealthy, intellectual, and famous came there, Sylvia Plath, Ray Charles, and Robert Lowell among them, that many people around Cambridge had come to think of it less as a mental hospital and more as a kind of sanatorium, where high-strung poets, professors, and graduate students wound up for a special kind of R&R. The resident on duty that evening urged Nash to sign a voluntary paper. Nash refused. There was a great movement for world peace, he said, and he was its leader. He called himself the Prince of Peace. He was informed of his legal rights, including his right to file a petition for release. A tentative diagnosis was made, but this was not discussed with him. And a document applying to a judge for a 10-day commitment was filled out. He was then escorted to the admissions ward in Belknap 1, a low brick building on the north side of McLean's campus just beyond the administration building. Nash used the pay telephone in the lounge. He did not call a lawyer, but rang Feggy Levinson instead. John wanted to know how he could get out of there, she said. He said he wanted a shower. I stink, he said. Virginia Nash traveled up from Roanoke to see her son. She was devastated. She wept and wept, Emma Duchesne recalled, saying over and over that she could not bear to see Johnny in this situation. She seemed close to a breakdown herself. She did not offer Alicia any help, financial or otherwise. Alicia, who was very short of funds, about to give birth and mad with worry, was bitterly disappointed. She had counted on Virginia for support, but it was obvious that Virginia needed even more help than she did. Nash was soon transferred to Bowditch Hall, a low white frame building at the edge of the McLean campus. Bowditch was a locked facility for men. Within a couple of weeks, Robert Lowell, the poet, joined him there. Lowell was already famous, a dozen years older than Nash, and a manic depressive who was now enduring his fifth hospitalization in less than 10 years. For Lowell, it was a mad month, spent rewriting everything in my three books, translating Heine and Baudelaire, reworking Milton's Lycidas, which he believed he had himself written, feeling, I had hit the skies that all cohered. Thrown together like a bundle of kindling, unable to escape, as Lowell's widow, Elizabeth Hardwick, later put it, Lowell and Nash spent a good deal of time together. When Arthur Maddock came to visit Nash, he found 15 or 20 people crowded in Nash's narrow shoebox of a bedroom. In what turned out to be an oft-repeated scene, Lowell was sitting on Nash's bed, surrounded by patients and staff sitting at his feet on the floor or standing against the walls, delivering what amounted to a long monologue in his unmistakable voice, weary, nasal, hesitant, whining, mumbling. Nash was hunched over beside him. Maddock recalled in 1997, I don't remember anything of the conversation except that it was general. In other words, only one person spoke at a time, and that was most of the time Lowell. Basically, he was holding forth on one topic after another, and the rest of us were appreciating this brilliant man. Nash said very little, like the rest of us. Once a women's residence where no man had apparently entered since perhaps 1860, Bowditch was, in Lowell's words, now designated for ex-paranoid boys. The ones who thought there was nothing wrong with them and couldn't be trusted not to bolt. As such, it was oddly genteel. At Bowditch, Nash and his fellow inmates were treated to a maze of tender, fussy attentions suitable to old ladies. The crew-cut Roman Catholic nurses, many of them Boston University students, brought him chocolate milk at bedtime, inquired about his interests, hobbies, and friends, and called him Professor. Hearty New England breakfasts were followed by ample lunches and homey dinners. Everybody got fat. Nash had a private room, with a door that shut, a hooded nightlight, and a view. There were no screams, no violent episodes, no straitjackets. His fellow patients, thoroughbred mental cases, were polite, full of concern, eager to make his acquaintance, lend him their books, and clue him in to the routine. They were young Harvard cocks of the walk, slowed down by massive injections of Thorazine, yet so much more intelligent and interesting than the doctors, as Nash confided to Emma Duchesne when she came to visit. There were also old Harvard types, dripping crumbs in front of the TV screen, idly pushing the buttons. Nearly half of McLean's patients were geriatric, like Lowell's Bobby Porcellian 29, who strutted around Bowditch late at night in his birthday suit. Yet there Nash was, stripped to his underwear, his belt and shoes taken away, standing before a shaving mirror that was not glass but metal. As for his view the next morning, in Lowell's words, "Azure day makes my agonized blue window bleaker." The days must have seemed very long. Hours and hours go by. Above all, there was the terrible awareness when visitors came that they were free to go back through the locked doors through which they had come, while he could not. It was in no way horrible. He was merely, as another inmate of a mental hospital once put it, considered beyond reasoning with, and treated like a child, not brutally, but efficiently, firmly, patronizingly. He had merely relinquished his rights as an adult human being. Like Lowell, he must have asked himself, "What good is my sense of humor?" Alicia urged everyone they knew to visit Nash. Peggy Levinson organized a visitor's schedule. The feeling was that with the support of friends, Nash would soon be on his feet again. "Everyone at MIT felt responsible for trying to make Nash better," recalled Feige in 1996. At McLean, all felt the more companionship and support he had, the quicker he would recover. One afternoon, Al Vasquez ran into Paul Cohen, who was extremely upset. He had been out to McLean to visit Nash, and he'd been turned away. What had happened, he told Vasquez, was that McLean had some sort of list of verboten visitors. "He was on the list," Vasquez recalled. "And I was on it, too. I was really shocked." Vasquez, along with most of the students in the department, hadn't even known that Nash was in the hospital. "It was a list of some sort of committee. I remember Cohen being very upset. That was the first time I was aware that Nash had been hospitalized. I have a memory of about 20 people on the list, almost all of whom were in the math department. Cohen must have told me some of the names. It was the hospital that wouldn't let people on the list see Nash. I called it the Committee to Rule the World." At first, Nash, who found it strange shuffling around without his shoes, was furious. "My wife, my own wife," he said to Adriano Garcia, one of the first to visit. He threatened to sue Alicia for divorce, to take away her power. Jürgen and Gertrude Moser recall a similar conversation. "He was very resentful," Moser remembered, "but otherwise not very different." Gertrude was initially very sympathetic and somewhat outraged at the way Nash was being treated. "He doesn't seem crazy," she said. Emma Duchesne, who also visited Nash in Bowditch, recalled that Nash was nicer to her than he had ever been. "He was saying such reasonable things," she said. When Giancarlo Rota and George Mackey, a Harvard professor, came, Nash joked about the oddness of locked doors, remarked how strange it was to be held there, and told them in the most rational tone that he was aware that he had been having delusions. When Donald Newman came to visit him, Nash asked him half-jokingly, "What if they don't let me out until I'm normal?" To Felix Browder, Nash complained that staying in the hospital was too expensive. The daily rate that spring was $38. Some of his visitors wondered what he was doing there. Donald Newman was the most vehement that Nash was sane. "There's no discontinuity," he kept repeating. Garcia recalled in 1995, "I was totally appalled by the fact that his wife had done this. I couldn't believe my idol was under the thumb of some stupid nurse who had total power over him." The medication, initially an injection of Thorazine immediately upon admission, calmed Nash down, made him drowsy and slow of speech, but did nothing to dispel the deep underlying unreality. Nash told John McCarthy, who also came out, despite his horror of hospitals and illness, "These ideas keep coming into my head, and I can't prevent it." He told Arthur Maddock that he believed that there was a conspiracy among military leaders to take over the world, that he was in charge of the takeover. Maddock recalled, "He was very hostile. When I arrived, he said, 'Have you come to spring me?' He told me with a guilty smile on his face that he secretly felt that he was the left foot of God and that God was walking on the earth. He was obsessed with secret numbers. 'Do you know the secret number?' he asked. He wanted to know if I was one of the initiated." For the first 2 or 3 weeks, during which time McLean had applied to a judge for an extension of the observation period for another 40 days, Nash was watched, studied, and analyzed. A biography was written. A young psychiatrist was assigned to construct Nash's life story, a complete catalog of his personality covering no fewer than 205 separate topics. All that led up to this disaster was included, family, childhood, education, work, past illnesses, and so forth. When it was done, the history was presented to a case conference attended by McLean's senior psychiatrists, and a more definitive diagnosis was arrived at. From the start, there was a consensus among the psychiatrists that Nash was obviously psychotic when he came to McLean. The diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia was arrived at very quickly. "If he was talking about cabals," said Kahn, "it would have been almost inevitable."